is like a couch.
I know.
Psychoanalysis.
So. Absolutely. This is really this. If you give us a moment. just so many compelling thoughts. And in this issue of this conversation around anti-fragility, in so many ways you're hitting upon issues that have really very tangible, immediate relevance to Finns and Finland in particular. Issues around risk, individual risk-taking, trial and error or small error, impacts of education on all of that. So these are very timely and relevant concepts. But before we get to that, I want to take a second, if I might, and just talk about you.
Oh.
Well, I asked you the question anyway. So for those who don't know, Nassim grew up in Lebanon. You left when you were, what, 14, 15?
Yeah, I left there. And I'm going back. I'm going there the day after tomorrow. Yeah. I kept links. I'm Greek Orthodox from Lebanon. So right. It's a threatened minority that you understand.
Right.
But we've survived up until recently. Right.
So you came from a country that was at one time considered sort of the Beirut was the
Greek,
Paris of the Middle East.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And all the chaos.
Yeah, and you had a lot of tolerance and
right.
stuff like that. Then,
now,
yeah.
And, how much of the fact that you grew up through these stresses, do you think impacted your thinking today?
I think Gladwell and the New Yorker wrote don't tell him a great bio, all right? But he made that association because it's a salient trait in someone's resume. He survives the war. I don't think much because when I became a trader, I used to make bets on disorder, mm-hmm. and all the people who went to my high school. And, became traders. A lot of them became traders. A lot of Lebanese people became Christians. A lot of them left and became traders. And all of these people had the opposite strategy of betting on order, okay? Mm-hmm. And I used to hunt for disorder. So I think that this... and a lot of people in the Midwest who had an extremely flat, I would say, childhood, mm-hmm. A very standard flat childhood with no trauma, were... like to bet on disorder. So I think it's more of your personal idiosyncratic traits than a circumstance. But what I'm certain is that the war in Lebanon had the effect of leading to some kind of post-traumatic growth, mm-hmm. where you have more energy, more to overcompensate, mm-hmm. but not in the formation of ideas. Mm-hmm. I think it's more in the temperament than in the ideology.
When you were young, were you as much of a non-traditional or non-linear thinker as we see you today?
I was, okay. I had one thing I didn't talk about, I was hoping, seeing you, I know we're going to talk about it now, is education.
Yeah.
Is I think that education is okay. This is why, it's not very good because, in higher doses, because it sort of doesn't teach, it selects for those who don't know how to handle uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Right, and this is why great scientists like Darwin, Einstein, Grothendieck, all the big scientists are people who were not into the traditional mm-hmm. education system simply because it kills creativity and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So, when I was about 14, I decided to become a writer. So, and I realized that if you stick to school. It narrows what you're going to know, all right? And to be a writer, you have to read a lot of books. So I started reading wholesale. And it saved me the bad part of education where you have, to read a certain number of books. And so it, the narrow education, the broader one. And I think that's what saved me from this, race, the education race. So I developed, very quickly an anti-education. I think the only way you can learn things is if you're autodidact. Mm-hmm. And it allows you not just to have a breadth of things, but to focus on things that are really important to you, not to some second-rate person who teaches high school, right? Mm-hmm. And I hated my high school teachers. You can understand I was quite rebellious. So that's
the he most. He was not in Finland, by the way. He was in France.
Okay. So it was a. So I think that helped me a lot, reading a lot of books.
You know, right. The great American author Mark Twain once said, "I never let school get in the way of my education."
Yeah. that writers usually don't like formal education.
But obviously, in an engineered world, in a world that's so technically complicated, you've got to have, to deal with it, you have to have some educational prowess.
It's good to have a minimal education, but not to focus on school. Because anything people are going to teach you at school is useless already, or has been used. So it's one thing you learn as a trader. Anything you're going to read in the newspaper, say the first 15 pages of the newspaper, is of absolutely no relevance to anything that's already priced in.
Okay.
So that's the way, it's the same way to view education. So and of course you look at metrics, you add education. Education is not what happened at school. And actually there's a big myth that rich countries have good systems of education. It's the opposite. Typically countries become rich.
Mm-hmm.
Then they catch up by having more education. And if you compare apprenticeship, which is more tinkering, trial and error, more doing things, apprenticeship is something very prevalent in Switzerland and Germany, mm-hmm. and I don't know about Nordic countries. That's vastly more important than education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in America now we have, of course, the big, well, just to prove that the big, the dropout culture,
mm-hmm.
But if you think of, if we forced Steve Jobs,
Zuckerberg or any of those
Zuckerberg,
guys.
Zuckerberg, the guy
Bill
with
Gates.
Microsoft, Bill Gates. I think Bill Gates would have, he'd be now a corporate lawyer, all right? To think about it. The other people, McKinsey consultants, that kind of stuff, all right? So you can imagine that would have lost. So education, plus if you have a good education, it lowers your risk taking, you see, mm-hmm. because you have a lot more to lose than when you have no education. You see, and typically people, risk takers, start taking risks early in their lives, mm-hmm. when they're in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I think education is something. Now, I'm a professor at university.
They must love you at the faculty, right?
And they hate that. But actually, I'm a professor of engineering. And engineers have this this culture that is, in fact, more anti-mathematical. They like mathematics, but so there's the engineers have the different culture. This is why I picked an engineering school. Economics, of course, it's a waste of time, and they would have crucified me by now.
Feeling good about this so far? Finns are very proud, rightfully so. I mean, they're really well educated, but I think that one of the challenges for Finland in the 21st century is, and it's something I have experienced in Europe, is an aversion to risk taking. The idea that you can, by taking out the bumps and trying to get stability, you can have predictability and safety, and of course that runs counter, that makes things more fragile as you see the world.
Yes, I mean, we have the few things that have worked for Europe, and in fact, it's backwards. Say, Germany is probably the country in Europe that has a big country in Europe that has fared well over the past, comparatively mm-hmm. well. And the real reason is because the Allies, when invading Germany, decentralized the place to prevent Berlin from, coming back for the third time. They said, okay, no more Berlin. So by decentralizing Germany, they forced the Germans, who are very good engineers and have a culture of apprenticeship, of staying in a middle-sized company framework, no big top-down corporation, because you don't have a strong state like France that helps top-down corporations. So that model, Switzerland and Swiss, but particularly German, especially German model, seems to be a very potent model,
mm-hmm.
and probably the most successful in history. So Europe has a lot of things going for it. Plus, another thing, that Europe is not really... Europe had the rise of states, but it took time to integrate. Is more still a collection of city-states.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice that whatever, the smaller the state, the better in Europe, the better it fares. And hopefully European Union will accelerate the breakdown of France into, nominally they could be part of the state, but like Barcelona would be independent. you see, or it's more and more independent. So maybe that European Union will do what the Roman Empire did. The Roman Empire was an empire, which is a combination of city-states and a big top mafia lord preventing them from fighting, you see, versus that integrated idea that the French want of everybody integrated in one country rather than have a collection of things like canton-like, like Switzerland, where it's bottom-up. Mm-hmm. But I think the European structure is strong enough for that, so you have the benefits of the local and maybe some kind of structure for things that are not entirely local.
You know, if I think about the U.S. and creativity and where things are happening, it's almost all at the local level. The farther we seem to get away from the federal government, the lower we get down in the structure, we get much more innovation, creativity, and more anti-fragility.
Yeah, the state has always, the state is very good for a few things. The states is, you know, of course, is, you know, they like wars. I said city-state. City-states like commerce, nation-states like war. But the whatever they get involved in, they usually mess it up by having intellectuals. And that's what happened in China and Egypt. Egypt, the pharaonic Egypt, was not an empire. It was a state. In other words, everything had to be decided by the scribes and a class of scholars, and it fell apart. And the same thing with China. China got very rich, a lot of invention. The minute they concentrated everything in the imperial Beijing, the thing fell apart. So in the United States, unfortunately, now we're concentrating with Washington. You have traffic jams in Washington. But there are two cultures in the United States. So there's the culture of the intellectuals who think that the state, you know, that's fine. We need the state for a lot of things. I'm not a real libertarian. I'm more of what I call localist, all right? Mm-hmm. But California had that wonderful culture, been carrying the world, actually, all right? And you know, you look at what you're doing. You use most of what we have, cell phone, all these things have been, you know, largely either designed, invented, or implemented in California. The California is a culture of failure. It's entirely a culture of tinkering, where it's very respectable to try, fail, and try again. Mm-hmm. Whereas in France or in Asian cultures, failure is not seen upon, again, seen, there is a social stigma with failure. So the best way for a country to do well is to treat the entrepreneur as a soldier. If a soldier, you know, who fails, all right, there's no such thing as, so unless, you know, you run away from battle. If you die in battle, you say, okay, he died for the sake of others. So we should do the same with entrepreneurs. Say, you keep trying for the sake of others, because one of you will find something that will help the place and feed us all, and you have enough of social structure, you know, to share these profits. So you should encourage entrepreneurs rather than especially failed entrepreneurs. And knowing that failure is respectable, people will try. We keep trying new things.
Right. So just to be clear, in case there are any politicians out here, he's not saying you should shoot the entrepreneur. Not saying that. So Finland is a culture as much of Northern Europe where there has been it's a growing sort of risk aversion and failure, which a word I don't like because it's the tinkering is much better.
Exactly.
It's always this continuum.
Yeah.
But failure is a blight on the resume. You mean, as you sort of mentioned, in Europe, if I give you my resume and I've failed in a business, they're going to say, thank you very much, Bruce, we'll get back to you. And they put it in the, you know, won't call this guy back pile. And in the U.S., if you give me your resume and
depends
you haven't had the failure, I say, come back when you know something.
Depends in the U.S., where in the U.S. U.S. is a culture, used to be a culture, throughout the country. But now that we've had Washington, and it's not, you know, I'm not...
You won't defend
both sides.
Okay.
No, both sides have done their share.
Yeah.
To change the so whatever Washington touches is bad, okay, because they want good grades, Harvard, this that kind of education, and of course no failure. And whatever is organic, you know, Californian or Middle America or Texan now, is a culture of failure.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, failing is a badge of honor. You say, you know what, failed 7 times. How about you? People are proud of the failure. You don't see that in Europe.
Yeah. So how do if let's go on the premise that your analytics here are correct, that to become more powerful, stronger, fitter, you've got to be anti-fragile, which means change, certainly here in Finland, means changing your relationship to risk, to certainly small risks anyway.
Yes.
Is there, what's the 5-point plan? How do you do that and, you know, how do you change a culture?
Protect entrepreneurs who fail. Okay.
You're talking about financially, bankruptcy laws?
There's 1-point plan.
One point plan.
Change the culture of failure. Say it's okay, you know, and cultures can change very quickly, right? Just like California's culture is something that well, 1 point, all right? You got to try a lot of times.
So I just out of curiosity. Do you, as Finns here, do you think that's possible? Do you think it's an easy 1-point plan program? Just change how you think about not succeeding the first time. Easy? Yes? No? No. Okay, okay, but why? All right, then, because you hear, so what's your response?
They spend too much time in school. That's the problem, because in school you fail an exam, it's not good, right? Okay. That's the problem.
I'll get you some Marines to protect you on the way to the airport. So a challenge here. This is a very school-centric country.
Yeah.
Many people get PhDs and such, and that's wonderful, but what you're saying is to be anti-fragile, to succeed as much as in nature, you've got to get out of school and basically be a risk.
Or you can stay in school. I mean, I stayed in school, but I mean, I came back to school later. But so long as you don't take academics seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I tell you, the problem we have in universities, you've got too many professors. They're very dangerous for knowledge. And you can actually, even if you look at history, in Anti-Fragile, I looked at history of formation of knowledge. There's that big illusion that knowledge comes from the state, the schools, you know, sort of, there's some kind of mingling. But and in fact, you look at the Industrial Revolution. Who started the Industrial Revolution? A bunch of adventurers, right? They had no idea what was going on, and they were not educated, okay? And of course they were tinkerers, and they pulled Europe, you know, into the modern world. And guess what? It's completely thankless because, and now that the English, the British have decided that, you know what, we're going to have Whitehall decide on, you know, creating the next Industrial Revolution. These things came bottom up. You're not going to suddenly, you know, transform them to top down. Yeah. But you look at the big contribution in science. You have Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, and then you look at where did knowledge come from? Knowledge. I'm talking about scientific knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Darwin was a country, squire, but there's typically country squires, amateurs, hobbyists, and country squires. Right. You know, from the steam engine to the theory of evolution came from these guys. So you realize that the strengths of Europe was a culture that I'm not saying that education is bad. I'm saying this kind of format for education kills the whole idea. Having a library, tinkering, the web now, going to a bar, getting drunk, getting into a fight, this kind of thing, this kind of atmosphere. But you pick up things. There's a lady who wrote a book on that, an English person, and it was at a party. And then she said that education, and she showed education doesn't improve GDP. And there's a person who didn't like the idea. He said, "But what do you call, you know, what for you, how should we educate people?" She looked at him and said, it was a cocktail party. She said, "This is where ideas are transmitted, not in the classroom." Mm-hmm. You see, plus there's another thing that I mean, I don't know if there are many professors here, but the whole idea to use a professor as a repository of knowledge is strange. Because it's practitioners traditionally have taught practitioners.
Right.
Through chains of knowledge, a body of knowledge that is not measured in educational standard, but in Germany, for example, there's a whole culture of apprenticeship.
Right.
Where that body of knowledge is transmitted by doers to doers.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from the idea of failure, they have that body of knowledge. That's what you need to develop, not the other part.
Yeah.
So beyond high school, education has a, I would say, a very, very concave payoff.
Mm-hmm.
Apprenticeship has a huge payoff. And this is something that the Indians didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they need. And Modi now got it in India. He said, I'd rather start 1,000 high schools than a single university.
Well, you know, in some respects, if you think about whether it's Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or any of the Zuckerberg, what they needed from college was a dorm room.
Exactly. They needed friends. They needed, it's like when I say an MBA, what did you get from the MBA? My culture was drinks was not very good. And now that I after 2 years of Wharton, I came out, I knew every cocktail.
Yeah.
Right? So like this and how to calibrate them. And then, you know,
that's
very useful.
In school. Do you have any recommendations on, again, because this is a challenge for Finland today, you're talking large scale, okay, change education, do this, but for a personal practice, is there some, exercise that people could incorporate in their own personal practices to help them become more anti-fragile?
You have a strong state here. The risk of unemployment is not very high. But I have a case study in my book, just like I compare two states, one with pseudo-stability, the other with stability, that try to avoid any job. If you're a corporation, try to avoid having subscriptions or investing in a company that has subscription. It's much better to have the same income from fluctuation because your subscription can dry out and disappear. So you don't want to have a niche in a base, you want to have fluctuation. So in my book, I have the story of two brothers, twin brothers, Cypriots, both, right? The editor wanted to make me remove that they're both from Cyprus, where they're twins, and I kept, and then I decided to change editor. So that's another thing about writing, right? The writing is tinkering, right? So the two brothers, one of them worked for an insurance company in the personnel department and had a very predictable income for a long period of time. The brother was a taxi driver, had a lot of volatility, both had the same income. Now, who's more fragile? Who's more stable? Well, someone would tell you, yeah, this guy has a steady income. You saw what happened to HSBC yesterday, fired 50,000 people. If you're 55, laid off in the UK, what are the odds after a 30-some-year career in the same firm? What are the odds of landing another job? I think there's nothing I know in life that's as close to zero probability as that, right? Okay. That would be the black swan, would be finding another job.
Basically, you're giving me bad news.
So the other brother is a taxi driver. So let's say, why is the other brother better off? Because conditional on surviving, he has to prove himself every day. All right. He knows the shifts. So every period of every dry spell where you don't have you're not making any money, you realize, hey, where the sucker, the tourists are not going to be in this area. They're in Camden Town now. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or the drunk people who overpay for cabs, they don't hang around here. They hang around there. Or you switch the airport, it's better to be at the airport at 11 a.m., not 4 p.m. So you figure out over time all the heuristics and tricks that would help you survive. So at any point in time, you're going to have fluctuations, but in the long run, your income, the probability of income going to zero is very small. Whereas the other one has a steady income and a gold watch every 25 years of service, and puff, he's laid off from HSBC or someone, and that's it. So for your own career, it's much better to have this kind of survival variability, number one. Variability is good for you if you learn, because it forces you to learn from it. The other one is anti-fragile, well, like some kind of dispersion. Mm-hmm. You see, the dispersion is, that you have, so it's better to have many sources of income. So that's what people don't realize, that it's much better to be a belly dancer and banker than either belly dancer or banker, right? So it may not seem efficient, but monoculture has really been bad for countries. It also can be bad for a person, all right? So good to have a dual career or more than one career like U.S. ambassador part time and businessman as as a hobby, right? That kind of thing. You get the idea, all right? So it's better to have these things.
I thought we were friends. Oh, okay. So one more thing. Just I want to talk about sleep.
Sleep.
Well, just the role of. You look at some very successful entrepreneurs are people who actually sleep very little and are very effective in cat napping.
I have no idea. I looked at sleep as something that, I like the Lindy, what I call the Lindy effect is take things that have been around for a long time as indicator of their, their robustness or epistemologically of the truth value. So I looked at walking, all right? And I said, it looks like we misunderstood sleep. We thought that sleep was something we could overcome. And it turning out that we still don't know why we sleep, but why ask questions? Just go with what's good for you, all right? Or heuristically, if sleeping, we don't understand how it works. Still, in the long run, you can see that those who sleep have, more hair and, something that applies to us. So sleep more. So the idea, we don't understand sleep, but we've done it for a long time. So let's not rationalize out of it. And I think walking is the same thing. Mm-hmm. We've been walking forever. Mm-hmm. So what I try to do is sleep as much as I can and walk as much as I can. So given that, it's hard to walk, because we don't live in a naturalistic environment. So I use an app. I use the app just to make sure that it's a discipline, that I have my 10,000 steps a day, right, as a minimum.
And if you can sleepwalk, it's the perfect...
So these things, there's a lot of stuff to humans. So you think you're wasting your time sleeping or wasting your time. I try to walk as much as possible, all right? Mm. And given that the human brain doesn't work the way we think it works, I've discovered heuristically that the more I walk, the better I... I have a real day job, which is producing academic papers and stuff like that. I have ratio of whether I'm writing for the larger audience or I call it practical or philosophical, or the other one is more mathematical, is I produce a rate of one paragraph per mile and a half, all right? So I walk. So if I'm writing and I get bored, I go for a walk, all right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. So sleeping and walking to me are the same thing that we don't quite understand, but we need them. And the human body is too opaque for the top-down approach. So you got to heuristically figure out what's your thing. But this idea of, in the 70s, 80s, the idea was to reduce sleep because it was superfluous. Look at what happens to these people. You can look at them now and see how they aged.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a fabulous a morning for me to hear just a different way of seeing the world. So informative for me. Thank you for taking the time for the conversation.
Thanks very much.
Nassim Taleb.